This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Wonderful to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. We are fixing your finances, addressing your legal issues, and offering a bit of inspiration on today's show. Are you bad with money? Do you think you are, or are you actually a bit of a shocker? We were speaking to Amrun Musa, aka The Money Doctor, about turning that attitude around, and she was taking your questions too on everything from how much should you have in your emergency pot, especially during a pandemic, to a magic combination of numbers that can unlock your personal independence when it comes to money. Don't forget, we talk finance on the show on a regular basis, normally every Monday. And it was Ludmilla Maliver. So from finance clinic to a legal clinic, she was on hand looking behind the headlines, especially that ownership law change, and answering your questions on, well, just about everything. Lots of personal questions in around living with your girlfriend, being unmarried and pregnant, but an awful lot of you getting in touch having not been paid your gratuity. She was on hand with an excellent resource to help you get back what is yours. And speaking to some amazing young people, from Ashe, who has started his own sneaker empire with a big eye on the future of the planet, to Neelam, single mum, and her son Dhiram. He's a young man of determination who has really got his sights set on starting a business to help support his family. Really inspirational stuff. And as ever, if you know someone here in Dubai or elsewhere in the world that we need to talk to, we need to celebrate, and we could learn from, never hesitate to get in contact with the show. Enjoy.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking money this afternoon, and is there such a thing as being bad with money? Maybe you're eating in a restaurant and always picking up the bill, or maybe it's comes to burying your head in the sand with financial admin. Or maybe you have earned a reputation as the opposite, being great with money. It's something that is a bit of a superpower of yours. Which one are you? We are joined live by Amrun Musa, founder of financial comparison site SukarMal.com. She's also known as The Money Doctor, on hand to take your questions, your queries. And of course, we know when it comes to talking about money and finances, and whether that's saving, spending, debt, don't worry about putting your name on it. We 100% understand. I just want to make sure you get the answers and hopefully the reassurances that you need. Now, Amrun, do you think there is such a thing as being inherently bad with money?
Hi, Helen. How are you? Thank you for having me on the show,
pleasure,
first of all.
Pleasure, pleasure.
Listen, I think there is such a thing as being bad with money, but I think at the same time, it's to do with what your objective is. It's to do with what you're trying to achieve. I think when we say, you know, are we bad with money, it's particularly what society or what around us we are expected to do and we're expected to achieve at some point of time in our life, which is financial independence.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, by someone thinking that they're bad with money, the danger is it becomes then a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and you make mistakes, you expect yourself to be in a bit of a financial hole. And maybe it's a case of changing that mindset to, well, thinking I'm bad with money, I'm useless, I'm always going to be broke, to I haven't quite learnt the skills yet of managing my money, but I will. So what would be the first thing you'd say to someone who comes to you saying they're bad with money, but they do want to get better?
Look, I love what you just said. And I think you're absolutely right on this, is many of us think, you know what, it's never going to get any better. This is how I've always been. This is the role model I've always seen. So this is the way it is. It doesn't have to be that way. There is so much information out there, and we'll talk about it a bit later on, but we even launched lately last week an actual program to help you get there. It's a financial education program for employees strictly. But I think what we have to be clear about is, it's for me, it's always like, you know, if you're bad with money and you don't know where you're going, there is a reason you don't know where you're going. It's a bit like going into a car and saying, I'm going to a restaurant, but I don't have a GPS, nor do I have a map. Well, I'm not going anywhere. But if I just make that little effort to find out the location of where I'm going to, everything changes, right? You may deviate, you may miss out the right turn, or you may miss the left turn, but you're kind of going in the right direction. And that's the analogy I would use generally. So just a little bit of effort and putting some structure around, you'll be surprised how many people who are meant to be quote unquote bad with money become actually very good with money. And it's just pure education. It's just making that little effort, finding out how are the simple ways to get around budgeting can go a long way. Helen, you'd be surprised how much your mind and your emotions impact your financial decisions, and also very often create a pattern on how we manage money. So it's about breaking that pattern and learning how to become quite structured about it.
I don't think I'd be surprised at all. I think a lot of us get really emotional with money, and that can kind of manifest in a number of different ways. In some ways, it is literally burying head in sand, being like, la, 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 I'm not going to talk about this. I'm not going to open my bills. When the text comes through from the bank, I'm just going to just delete that and just worry about that. That's a problem for my future self, and, you know, good luck to them.
This is probably the biggest mistake most of us do. And I will not lie to you. I actually used to do it at some point just because I didn't want to deal with it. I'll have a look at it later. The whole procrastination idea is like, because I don't want to face it, I'll postpone it. And the more you postpone it, the worse it gets, right? So the first thing you want to do is when that statement comes in, is take that statement, look through it, and make sure, first of all, there hasn't been any fraud, any theft, any misbuying that you can let the bank know. And little things like when that credit card statement comes through, things like insurance. I don't know if you've ever heard about that, but there is a particular insurance that banks normally put on credit cards, which is a credit shield insurance, which protects you supposedly for, you know, job loss and whatnot, which is great. But if you haven't signed up for it, often what I've seen is you get charged without even knowing about it. So there's always a reason to check and look at that statement every single month. And remember one thing, everything that's on that statement has been your own doing. You've spent that money. So
no.
You might as well face it now. It's not, it didn't just come out of nowhere.
Like, we're actually going to be looking at next week. It's all about
shopping. They shouldn't be surprised.
I know.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking money this afternoon, are you in money trouble? Or maybe you want to save more. Maybe you're fortunate to be in a good spot right now, but want to maximise your earnings and look after your future self. If you do have any personal finance questions, this is your chance. They'll be answered by Amber and Musa. She is the founder of financial comparison website SukAlMal.com. She's also known as the Money Doctor. Lots of you getting in touch with your feelings around, well, your feelings for money. No name on this one, Amberine, but saying, I really feel that social media, etc., have set impossible standards for our younger generation. We've become a culture of debt and trying to keep up with the Joneses, all the while destroying our mental health and spiraling further into debt. I've recently reviewed our finances, decided to be stopped being sucked into this and sort it out to have some quality of life. Is this something you've heard from clients of all ages? Because I'm not reading that. Nodding along heartily indeed.
Oh, absolutely correct, Helen, and thank you for whoever sent that message. But you're absolutely right. I think it's not getting obsessed with the spiral of debt. It's the problem is trying to live beyond your means, right? It's about not sitting down and figuring out, can I even afford this? And because of social media and all the online likes and shares and whatnot, unfortunately, instant gratification has become a big part of the new generation growing up. And when it comes to instant gratification, it's about getting it now and getting satisfaction now versus working and keeping ourselves, our savings up to a certain level where we can get something later and get that satisfaction. You know what they say, right? The longer you wait to get something, the satisfaction lasts longer as well. But unfortunately, with all social media, instant gratification has become very, very important. And how you look and the type of lifestyle that you live has become quite a big one because, you know what, you can be a hero for a day today. You get suddenly 500 likes on one post, you suddenly feel like a hero. And that feeling is what's driving a lot of the consumption above and beyond the means of what people can do. So I think education, again, becomes an extremely important part of it.
And this is us saying this is, you know, women who are, you know, pretty sophisticated consumers of media. Yet I know that I have had that pesky algorithm put the same thing in front of me three times on my desktop, on my laptop, on my phone. I'm like, oh, fine, I'll just buy it. if it's going to complete my life the way the algorithm seems to think it's going to, then clearly it's a sign. Never mind the younger generations.
Well, think about it next time is, you know, when someone continues, exactly what you said, fine, I'll buy it. Don't forget that if you ever get into trouble with your credit cards, the debt collectors will come and keep pestering you as much as those pair of shoes were pestering you. And they will be calling you 15 times a day to pay your debt.
So at least I'll be looking
maybe
good.
That's something that kind of think you can think twice about buying it then.
And this is why, you know, you talk about instant gratification. It is exactly that. It's, you know, it's a swipe up to buy. You get the hit of the instant shopping and then you get the hit of the delivery. As I said, if anyone is really suffering from what you might not consider to be shopping addiction, but maybe someone in your family might, then please do reach out. We'd love to help you on next week's show. Coming to the text line, Sol, a simple question, but probably quite a complicated answer, saying, what are your thoughts on renting versus buying in the UAE? You know, we're hearing from Emaar sales going up hugely based on last year in the first 5 months of 2021. I've got friends who work in rental saying there's not a lot of stock around right now as well. But when it comes to the financials, Amberine, what are your thoughts?
Look, I love this question. I actually recently purchased a property in Dubai in August last year, actually. It was when prices actually were quite down. It was literally in the middle of lockdown and whatnot. But look, the question of whether it's the right time to buy or not, I love that question because it's all subjective. There is a right time to buy as long as you can afford it. So generally, the answer to this question is number crunching is a useful way to evaluate the buy versus the sell option, the rent option, right? But the ultimate decision will boil down to affordability and preferences. So you must consider all factors such as how long you plan to stay in the property. Is it a property only for investment? How flexible your monthly budget is? Are you getting into yourself into purchasing a property because it's supposed to be a good deal for now and the price has dropped 20%, but can you afford the mortgage every month? And what if you lose your job? Can you still afford it for the next 2 years? Or do you need to sell it at a price, even if it was a good deal, at a much lower price because you're distressed, right? So what's your current pool of savings? And what is your other debt obligations? So that question is a million-dollar question, but very hard to answer yes or no until we really look at someone's case and say, is this the right time to buy for you in the situation you are in today?
And I think that's bang on the money, so to speak. Amberine Moussa with us this afternoon to take your money questions. It can be a general question like Sol's, or it could be something specific to your own saving, spending, debt, and maybe helping with an action plan to get you out of that debt. Winnie messaged earlier, you're talking about that credit card shield that many companies put on, perhaps without our knowledge, but can cost us a pretty dirham or two over the course of a year. Winnie's saying, I always pay with my credit card to get the points, pay the full amount every month and on time, but are there any hidden charges? The fine print is crazy long and very small. Thank you. I would say, let's look at the positive, because sometimes there are some very nice things that you might not be aware of. If you are a good credit card user, you might be getting all sorts of perks that you haven't realised. I didn't realise I had roadside assistance until about a year ago. That was a nice surprise. But on the downside, there are some hidden charges that you might not be aware of. Amberine, what are some of the ones, the most common pitfalls that people might not have picked up on?
Look, I agree with you. I think sometimes we kind of go down the path, especially as a money doctor, you know, credit card's all bad. It's not all bad. If you use credit card, just like one of the listeners who just texted you, in the right way, I always say, if you become the bank's worst customer, you'd be laughing, because then you don't pay credit, you don't pay the fees, you don't pay the interest rates. You actually make the most out of the rewards. And the rewards on the credit cards are phenomenal. You can get, especially if you're flexible with timing, everything. But you need to spend responsibly on your credit card. Now, your credit shield sometimes can be a hidden charge. Now, the way I've seen it happen, having said that, not to be fair to the bank, is what I've seen is, in my case, it happened where the sales agent, after I signed the application form, ticked the box credit shield.
Oh,
and that's how
naughty.
Exactly. So you need to watch out for this. And one of my suggestions is fill in all the form, get it signed, take a picture of the form, and then keep it as a copy. Yeah. And I've seen this and I've heard it happen too. So just be very careful on that. That's how the credit shield came along. The other hidden charges are not really hidden. They are in the five prints everywhere, but it's your foreign exchange fee. So when you actually buy anything online on a site that is not part, that is not in the UAE and you're not paying in dirhams, there is a foreign exchange fee that gets applied, which is between around, depending, 2.5% to 3.5%. So if something costs you £200, it's actually £200 plus the 2.5%. You need to ask for your bank, and it's everywhere in your fine prints how much your foreign exchange fees are. And another little trick, often when you are at any shop externally outside the country or in on an online site that is not in the dirham, they will ask you, do you want to pay in dirham or dollar or euro? Always pay in the currency that you're buying in. So if it's £200, pay in £200. Because otherwise what happens is if you say, no, I'm gonna buy in dirham, the merchant of who you're buying decides the exchange rate. And generally your bank will give you the best exchange rate. Oh. So buy it in the other currency, which is not the dirham currency, and your bank will actually translate it for you.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're talking money this afternoon, and personal finance management is actually, despite what you might think, a concrete learnable skill. It's like driving a car or throwing a ball, but we just need to get past some of the sometimes structural, sometimes cultural, sometimes emotional roadblocks that prevent us from talking about it and learning about it. So if you've got any personal finance questions, get in touch with us now. They're going to be answered by Ambreen Musa, founder of financial comparison website Souq Al Maal. She's also known as the Money Doctor. So I wanted to ask you, Ambreen, one question we get an awful lot of is we often know we've got a problem, but how do we track? And a few people have got in touch asking for your recommendation when it comes to apps for budgeting. And I wondered what you use, anything regional or anything international that you think is super intuitive and easy to navigate.
Super interesting question. I actually don't use anyone. I use an Excel sheet, to be honest. It's old fashioned. Interesting enough, we're in the process of building one for the UAE, and which we'll be launching in the next couple of months, at the back of the financial education employee program that we launched last week. So as part of that, which is 9 module, and it goes through everything from budgeting all the way to if you want to buy a house in the UAE, it tells you exactly what are the costs, what are the laws, what are the regulations, what's the process, but it also tells you what the scams you need to be aware of, all the hidden fees. So it's a program that's not just for people to be careful about their money, but it's also a program for people who want to buy a house, buy a car, and very, very localized in the UAE. And there's one of the first module of this whole program is all about budgeting. And there is an Excel sheet already done for you in there where you just fill in the banks and your monthly cost, and it gives you automatically the your savings ratio. Your savings ratio is basically your how much are your expenses, removing the savings and the investment, but your expenses on your income and how far you are. And there's a certain number that you should always be under. The typical average, they tell you, is you should not go above, 70 to 80% of what you're earning today. So 70%, you are good. This means you manage your money really well. Keep on track. And 30% is going to either investments or savings or long-term plans. And if you're above the 90% of what you're earning, then you're in the red zone that we call it, where you probably would want to sit down with a piece of pen and paper and look at budgeting and how you're living from a lifestyle perspective.
Okay. Really hope that helps. And please keep us posted on when that is out, because I think that kind of hyper-local aspect is really, it's really important, because if I see something in dollars or pounds or euros, I kind of feel like this isn't for me. This doesn't feel really relatable to what I'm earning and what I'm spending in. So, yeah. Okay. Keep us posted on that. Coming to text line.
So the program is already live. It went live last week, and it's basically for all employees. So if you're interested, then your company HR can just contact us. And it's a program that's very affordable for companies, and they sign it up and all the employees have access to all 9 modules. And there's everything we've just talked about is all in there.
There you go.
And the tools to track it, your mortgage. But the app will come out in a couple of months. So definitely I will keep you posted on that.
In the meantime, a couple of people have suggested that, I wouldn't know if I'm saying it right, the YNAB app. So YNAB app. So thank you for that. Coming to the text line, 4001. P wants to know, and as I said, you don't need to put your real name on. We know when it comes to talking about money, it can be personal and private, and that's absolutely fine. The initial P says, my husband wants to start buying gold coins for the future, either for us or keeping it for our kids when they're older. I'm not convinced it's a great investment. What are your experts' thoughts?
Very, very good question. Look, gold has been respected throughout the world for its value for thousands of years, and it's been in a lot of cultures for thousands of years. Now, the people actually continue to hold gold for various reasons, some culturally, some economy-wise. But I would say the key takeaways is throughout history, gold has been seen as a very special and valuable commodity, right? And today, owning gold can actually act as a hedge against inflation or deflation, but also probably quite a good portfolio diversifier. As a global store of value, I mean, gold can also provide you financial cover during a lot of macroeconomic uncertainty. For example, there's a few countries right now where there's been devaluation of the currency fully. gold is not a bad asset to actually own. In that case, and again, the bottom line is you really need to understand why you're the buying. It's an important part of a diversified investment portfolio. Because as well, as you would see price increases in response to events that cause the value of paper investments, such as stock, bonds, and all of that to decline. And so all the price of gold can be volatile in the short term. If you look at history of gold, it has always maintained its value over the long term, right? So through the years, it has served as a hedge against inflation, erosion of major currencies, where you see massive devaluation. So from my perspective, I think it's a great investment as a diversified portfolio. Having said that, don't forget that it's probably not as liquid as cash. So it depends on, again, why you're purchasing this and whether you do need that money tomorrow, or whether you'll be forced to sell the gold, and all of that.
Okay. Hope that helps, P. So as Amri's saying then, not to make up 90% of your investment, but certainly part of a diverse portfolio, then yeah, if you're happy to play the long game, go for it.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about money matters now with Amberine Musa. She's the founder of SukalMal.com. It's a financial comparison website. She's also known as the Money Doctor, and she's on hand to give you some impartial opinions and maybe offer some guidance as well. Mansi, I love this question, saying, can you give suggestions for pandemic-proof emergency funds? How much should be in the pot? This is a question we've addressed over the years a number of times about should you have, well, who knows, 3 months worth of saving, 6 months of saving. But the pandemic has thrown a pretty serious spanner in the works in that so much is uncertain. Amberine, what would you say to anyone who perhaps hasn't got that emergency fund? How much needs to go into it? And how on earth do you start to scrape that together when we're already worried about what's coming in?
That's a fantastic question. What we would normally suggest is when you're actually doing your budget, there's a bit of a strategy called the 50-30-20. And it's always good to have that, right? I remember when I was 21, I had just my first job and I had no idea how much rent I could afford. And the rule is generally for rent is 30% of your income, not more than 30% should actually go into rent. But if we go back to, if you're looking at your budget all fully, the 50-30-20 rule is that 50% of your income goes into your actual needs, basic needs such as your house rent, your life insurance premium, your groceries, your utilities, your telco, and any of the debts that you have, which is a car loan. Now, I'm saying, a car loan is supposed to be a need because you've already bought it at this point. But if you haven't purchased a car yet, then it's to think about whether it's a need or a want. But typically, 50% of your income should go into your needs. And then 20% of your income should go into your savings. So that would be your retirement plan installment, transfer to emergency fund, or other long-term investment. And whatever is left, which is 30%, that's it's a well-known kind of rule across the world. The 30% would go then into your wants. Because one thing we have to also remember that, if you're going to be working hard, you also do want to enjoy life. You also don't want to keep everything into a pot in case something goes wrong one day and end up never really enjoying life. So the rule tells you 30% goes into your wants, which is the dining and the shopping and the movies and traveling as well. So now traveling really depends. But what instead of saying 30% or 20% or 10% should go into a traveling pot, it's more about your lifestyle altogether. So if I take the needs out and I take my savings out, which are the two things I would do first. So a lot of people go, okay, what do I need or what do I want? The difference between need and want is huge. And a lot of us very often, we think we need something when it's not really needed. So when you put your needs and your savings together, this should account for around 70% of your income. And whatever is left over, which is a 30%, is where then you decide what kind of lifestyle you can afford.
I love that because I think I have seen people do this, be so hardcore about saving, but my goodness, they're miserable.
I completely agree.
There is
the idea is not to also be miserable.
No,
right?
there's a balance to be struck, and we're lucky enough that we're living in a part of the world where we can eat good food and we can socialise, yes, and do it responsibly and see friends and hopefully travel a little bit. And we, of course, need to be looking about our future selves and our kids, but not at the expense sense of our happiness. So I think thank you for keeping it real. I love the sound of that 50-30-20. I'm going to look into that. And maybe that helps Shibi with this question saying, how much of your family savings should be allocated towards a summer holiday? That is a really personal question as well, because it presumably so much depends on how much you're earning and what kind of holiday you want. But when it comes to needs and wants, where would you put a holiday?
I would put a holiday totally into a want, right? Because you can have different types of holidays which cost you a bomb, and you can actually have an amazing picnic with the family and go camping with the family for 3 days, and it doesn't cost anything except for the food you bring with you. So the holiday, for me, it depends how you're not, but the holiday, it depends on the type of holiday, whether it's a need or a want. I think we all need a holiday at some point just to refresh ourselves. The type of holiday is what's important.
Amreen, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. I think it's been really, really valuable. And I think the idea of reframing that idea that you're bad with money, it's completely understandable. A lot of people just feel like that is their destiny. But with some education and some time, that can absolutely be flipped. For anyone who wants to find out more about the education program that you've launched, what's the best way of reaching out, whether that's someone as an employee who wants to put it forward to their company or someone who wants to offer it to their staff?
Absolutely. So it's called the Money Doctor Basic Program, and it's all available on moneydoctor.sukalmal.com. I'll say it again, moneydoctor.sukalmal.com. The whole program is there. What's in the program? There's a few introductory videos, so you get a feel of what the program looks like. And you can just email us at moneydoctor@sukalmal.com. But if you go on the website, there's loads of space. You can actually leave your email or contact us. And we'll reach out back out to you and see how many employees you have, what makes sense to you, and how long you want to take it for.
Well, thank you again for your time today, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is your free legal clinic this afternoon with none other than Ludmila Yamalova from HPL Malvern Pluka. We're going to be looking through the latest headlines, but also going to your questions. Many have already come in on social media through the SMS 4001 and, of course, through the ARN Play app. Ludmila, so many questions for you, my dear. So prepare to be busy. So what's been happening in the land of law over the last week or so? I'm guessing a lot of chat about ownership of companies.
Obviously, but that's a subject that has been on the agenda for the last, since last September. So it's just that as of June and as this month, that the DED and the licensing authorities have now made it available for those who are applying for new companies to set them up, in particular LLCs, and that's companies on the mainland outside of the free zone. Now they can set them up without the requirement of a local sponsor or a local agent. So once again, the law was introduced back in September of 2020, but the implementation of it ultimately came into effect as of this month. And so that's been a very significant and very exciting news. Now, one clarification that keeps coming up is whether this law applies retrospectively to all the existing LLCs. And the answer to that is no. This law applies only to new LLCs. So if you are wanting to set up a trading company today, you will no longer require a local partner. But for all those trading companies that have been set up in the past, the only way to modify, they can be modified, the legal structures can be modified, but with the agreement of the local partner. So in other words, the local partner would either have to sell their shares, transfer their shares, or somehow exit from the company. But just unilaterally, you cannot now get rid of, let's say, silent partners.
Okay.
That's one. And then the other clarification is there are still a few exemptions. So now the general rule, the default rule, is that you no longer need a local partner if you set up in the on the mainland, outside of the free zone. That's the general rule. But there are a few exceptions, such as, for example, there's seven industries that are of strategic importance, and that's obviously energy and military related and security and such. And those companies or companies within those industries will still require some degree of local either ownership or control or oversight. And that the details on that are yet to be released. And also professional services, for example, such as accounting firms and law firms and other types of professional services still require a local agent. So there are still a few limitations, but unlike the previous system where the default was that you're required to have 51% local ownership, and then there were a few exceptions. Now, the rule is, the general rule is that you no longer require local ownership control, with a few exceptions. So it's been kind of reversed upside down.
Okay, any specific questions relating to that, get them in. Going to the text line, Ludmilla, no name on this one, and that's absolutely fine by me. No name saying, my wife joined a large Abu Dhabi-based company 6 months ago. It has been rocky. Recently, she took a week of leave and was surprised that her salary was reduced. The HR manager said that holiday is only paid according to her basic. No mention of this before and nothing in her one-page contract. Any advice?
It's actually by law. By law, holiday is paid as per basic salary. One, and two, if depending on her agreement, but if holiday is taken during probation, often, or at least the law provides that if holiday is taken during probation, it is unpaid. So unless the contract provides otherwise. So it is actually consistent with the law, but then definitely she should review the contract, because sometimes and often, especially with large companies, contracts tend to be a little more generous than the basic provisions in the law.
Okay, hope that helps.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Incredibly lucky to have stolen away Ludmilla Malava for an hour. She's there at HPL and Malvin Pluka, but she's with us on Microsoft Teams today. Going to the text line, Ludmilla 4001, or the ARN Messenger app, of course, is there for you as well. No name on this one, saying, I run a very popular little business in my area upon request from the local parents. It's grown over the years, but I've got one huge problem. Clients that don't pay. And this is because the vast majority of them are my friends. Parents of the kids my own kids went to school with. How best to enforce? Oh, this gives me massive cringe, I have to say, because that's when the blurred lines can be problematic. What advice would you give on this front, Ludmilla?
Well, I mean, there's definitely two aspects to it. One is emotional, that stems from the personal relationships, and the other one is the legal. And so if it is a business, and if it's a popular business, and you are doing this because it's a business, it's a commercial enterprise, then you do need to, this is more of a practical advice, but you do need to put personal and emotional sentiments aside if you actually want to stay in business, because sooner or later, you will not be able to continue to run this popular enterprise if you don't get paid. And then in order to, so emotionally, you just kind of need to kind of lock it up and put it in a different box. And the best way to do it is if you have a proper legal foundation to start up with. And I'm not talking about some sort of a very elaborate or a complex agreement and such. It could be something very simple, like a one pager, ultimately, where the client confirms their debt to you. And so, or in other words, some sort of like an acknowledgement of debt or confirmation of a commercial debt. So, for example, you provide a product or a service and they sign off that, yes, I owe you X amount of money. Now, with a document like that, if it's simple but fairly specific, that document itself can easily become an enforceable instrument by using an expedited court process, which is called the payment order. And that's a process that has been introduced into the UAE, so jurisprudence, about a year, two years ago. And it's in the last year or so in particular, it has been used quite often. So it's a payment order. You can apply for it through the online court portal, which, by the way, most of the court proceedings these days are happening online and through the online portal. So you can do it from the seat of your home. And you apply for that, and then within a day or two, the court is supposed to issue a judgment. And if it is a confirmed commercial debt, a clear confirmed commercial debt, you will have an enforceable judgment ultimately within a day or two. There are a few other nuances to how to proceed from there on, but that is the best, that's the most enforceable, the most secure commercial instrument which you can use to protect your interests. Now, how far you want to go with that to try to enforce it, which ultimately will allow you to, seize their bank accounts and seize your friend's assets and such.
But at least
you have a commercial and legal instrument that you can rely on, in the event that push comes to shove and that's the only option that you have remaining.
I would also say get some processes in place with new customers as well, and whether that could be something when a booking is made or an order is placed, something sends out automatically from your email address, or even outsource. Get an accountancy company to be the one to send out the reminders so you don't feel like you're so emotionally involved in it. But yeah, those blurred lines.
It does cost extra money.
No, but if but it's better than better than no money that's coming in right now. Really hope that helps. let's hope, say we can help this listener. No name on this one, saying, good day. My local sponsor passed away in February of 2021. His legal heirs, more than one, are still in the process of appointing one nominated heir. The problem is they are moody communicators and I don't like being in the dark. If I were not to hear from them, what steps can I take to relinquish my company from their claim? I've already obtained approval to transfer his shares to me as a 100% owned from the DED. I just need all his heirs to sign on that document. I must add, I've got no financial claim to be settled to the sponsor that passed away. So yes, he has shares, but they account for 0 dirhams.
Actually, it's even though the phrasing of the question is that all that he needs is just get the, you know, sounds like a simple process. It is not a simple process. It can be extremely complicated. And as the listener specified, that he just needs the other legal heirs to sign off on it. Well, land of itself is a massive complication. So the reality is such that in legal terms and in practical terms, in order to do anything, either to transfer the shares of the late sponsor or to even sell your shares to the legal heirs, you will need to have the agreement of the legal heirs. Now, the legal heirs in and of itself is a legal definition. You know, who are the legal heirs? And until there is a final court judgment or court decision that clearly sets out who the legal heirs are, it's all very speculative, especially since the local sponsor would be a Muslim, so they'll be going through the Sharia court, and it all depends on the late sponsor's family structure at the time of his death in terms of who his legal heirs are and to what extent. So it is a lengthy process. It's not going to be easy. And whatever previous documents, for example, that could have been signed between the listener and his sponsor, including the late sponsor's permission, for example, to transfer shares, are not valid. In particular, the power of attorney, for example, because the power of attorney would ultimately die with the death of the sponsor. So it's not, unfortunately, a simple process. You'll just need to be very patient and ultimately work with the with whoever you think the legal heirs are. To figure out how to move forward. Now, in terms of you may be able to attach your interest to the distribution or the inheritance process, at least by setting up your own court process as an interested party. So at least in the very least, you might be able to gain some visibility to what's going on in terms of the inheritance and distribution of that particular share. But it's, you know, it's so also a process in of itself. But that would be the best way, at least, to give you some transparency in terms of what's going on the back end. But unfortunately, it's going to be a lengthy process.
Sounds really frustrating. Anonymous, sending you strength. A question from Farhat here. And Farhat, I sympathise. Farhat saying, can you please talk about noisy neighbours and what can be done about kids being loud and scratching your cars in a residential compound? As someone who lives with people who seem to be obsessed with firecrackers during the day, not just at night. Yeah, my neighbours suck. I think anyone who, whether that is a noise complaint or behaviour complaint, what advice would you give to Farhat and me, Ludmilla?
Sure. Well, so for the noise complaints, it's usually the municipality that gets involved, and it's noise in particular with regards to noisy neighbors, right? If it's, for example, a noisy car, then you could also you report this to the police. But with noisy neighbors, you'd have to, I mean, it depends on the level of noise. If it's some sort of a massive rave or a party, then you could also call in on the police. But if it's just the kids or families being rowdy, then the place to start with the municipality, and then ultimately, if it obviously becomes an uncontrollable, you can also call in on the police with regards to, I mean, and that's, you know, if they don't respond, first of all, I'd say, you know, you don't want to knock on the door. You don't necessarily want to ask them to be quiet because I think that can spiral things out of control. One option is to call the security in the building and ask the security to get involved before you call the police, because it is a bit of dramatic to call the police on your neighbors. But if all else fails,
I did it twice.
I mean, you know, sometimes it's the only option. And then with regards to scratching of the cars in the neighborhood, that's a matter for the police. Now you would call the police and you report the scratching the car, and you know, I guess you will let them know who you think the suspects are. And while the kids necessarily will not be called into the police, it would be their guardian. Mm-hmm. So the parents would be responsible for the actions of their kids.
Okay, all right. Really hope that helps, Farhat. Stay strong, my friend. Stay strong. Or like me, you could just move house. Seems a bit dramatic, but I've had enough.
Work-Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is your free legal clinic this afternoon. Ludmila Yamalova joining us live on Microsoft Teams to take your questions on any aspect of the law. Ludmila, lots of people getting in touch. It feels like work is giving people a lot of headaches. We're going to get through some of those. But I want to first come to Anna's question. She says, how is the situation looking now for someone who's pregnant in the UAE but not married? I know there were some changes in the law at the end of last year, but how does it actually look in practice? Is it still a crime? Can a pregnant woman get medical care without facing any legal action?
So there's several aspects to this, or I guess to this question. One, is it still a crime? No, it is no longer a crime. Two, can the unmarried woman get treatment and care? Yes, and she always could, even in the past when it was still considered to be a criminal offense. The hospitals and clinics would not require, for example, a marriage certificate in order to treat or supervise a pregnant woman, or even for a baby to be delivered. So the question would always come up at the delivery of the baby. So prior to that, it was not an issue. So as of today, the same practice continues, and in particular because now it's no longer a crime, so you can freely sign yourself up for it with clinics and hospitals and such. However, when the time comes to deliver a baby, the regulations in connection with the issuance of the birth certificate have not yet been amended. And in relevant parts, as per those regulations, a marriage certificate is still required for birth certificate to be issued kind of as an administrative step through the hospital. Without a marriage certificate, or if a marriage is less than 6 months, six months valid since the birth of the baby, then it's basically the same as not having a marriage certificate for the purposes of issuance or not of the birth certificate. And in those cases, you need to file a court case to request issuance of the birth certificate. So it's kind of a multifaceted question and issue. On the one hand, it's no longer a crime. On the other hand, also you can receive proper medical care. But with regards to the issuance of the birth certificate, laws still need to be amended. So in the meantime, my advice is that when the time comes to deliver, it would be best for the time being to deliver elsewhere. And then once you have your birth certificate from wherever the country is that you deliver, then you can come back here. And then on the birth certificate, by the way, we also have clients who have come here and sponsored children as single mothers, for example, with the birth certificate only reflecting one parent.
Okay, that's
so
amazing.
The authorities are open to that. It's possible. It's just the issuance of the birth certificate should come from a different country in that case for now.
And I really hope that helps you or whoever you are talking about today. Please do get in touch with Millers with us today. Anonymous message here saying, I was employed by a big construction company. It closed up shop and I have not been paid my gratuity. I've been going there for months. I was told last time to get in touch with the liquidators. I don't even know who they are. I'm not the only one. There are hundreds of us. What can we do collectively, or what can I do individually to get my money back?
So I have to tell you, so I'm very excited to update, and I'll continue to update and share the boots on the ground kind of intel as the process evolves. But most of the government services, and true to their promise to kind of embrace paperless government and smart government, the UAE has really, really embraced putting a lot of these government services online. So for this listener in particular, and all of his colleagues who are found in this situation, there's no reason to go to the company and try to get paid from the company. And obviously, the company is in trouble, and just going there physically and spending time there is really going to be a futile exercise, especially since they're facing financial difficulties. But there are ways now to file claims against the company just using your phone or your computer online. So, for example, if since it's a construction company, most likely it will be under a mainland company. And so you can go to the Ministry of Amortization and Human Resources website, and there you can file your claim straight from the website and against the company for obviously unpaid salaries. And at that point, you now have an employment case. And so, by the way, for employees, and depending on the amount of the salary, but it doesn't sound like this would be a very high salary, it would be actually free. So all you need to do, by the way, because these services are now more and more available through these online portals, all you need to do is just your labor card number, and then the system will kind of pull up all your details, including your contract details and all that. So you don't even need to submit any of your contract details or other documents. You just say, okay, here's my claim. I have not been paid a salary. And now you have an actionable claim. Now, with regards to this particular company and its financial distress and issues, employees' claims will always take priority. But you will only get that priority if you go through the courts. Mm-hmm. But if you go knocking on the door, that's not really, I mean, you will be the least of their priorities. But if you go through the official channels, you will be, your claims will be prioritized. And I just do want to highlight that these services are now very easily available online. So I encourage all those who find themselves in these unfortunate situations is to avail themselves to those services. And then things will move very differently than when they go there and knock on and mm-hmm. try to rely on the good graces of their bosses.
Ludmilla, can you just direct anyone to the right portal, the right website, just get that process started officially?
Yeah, so it's the Ministry of Amortization and Human Resources, or MOEHR, website. And from there on, it's not just in Arabic, so it's in English. So you can really guide yourself fairly easily. To log in, you just need your labor card number. And from there on, you'll be able, it's really self-explanatory. There's these pull-down menus. If you want to file a claim, it'll be able, just by your labor card number, you'll be able, once again, you kind of go into this portal, you open up, there'll be your contract and your employer's details. And so then you just click, I want to file a claim against this employer. So you don't even need to go get a copy of the trade license or the representative's name. It's all in the system already there populated. So it truly is just, it's a fairly methodical process that all you need to do is just pick something from a pull down menu. So truly Brilliant. Groundbreaking services that are becoming available more and more. And I tell you, every day we discover yet another service, another twist. But so this is a huge benefit to all those who find themselves in situations and easy to follow.
And it's great to hear about these processes often making things easier for the employee rather than the employer.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We have got the amazing Ludmilla Malworth joining us this afternoon, answering your legal questions. It is your last chance to get them in. We've got a couple to get through before 4 o'clock. One here, scams are plenty at the moment, unfortunately. Master saying, I purchased a 2-year freelance visa last year, which turned out to be a scam. It's actually a labour visa. Now there's a case against me at immigration. What would the punishment be and what should I do? Asks Anonymous on 4001. Ludmilla.
One thing is that you can never really purchase a visa. If you're ever offered to buy a visa, that in itself is a scam and that's improper. That's just one general comment. Now, with regards to this, and then also when you do, if you were to, let's say, so-called buy this visa, it would say on the visa whether it's a freelance visa or it's a labor visa. So, sounds like there wasn't much sort of attention to detail paid. Now, with regards to punishment, it falls under the UAE immigration laws. So depending on the circumstances of this particular matter. So let's say if you were caught working under the labor law, under this labor visa, I'm not sure exactly what services you were providing. So there'll definitely be a fine, depending on, again, the gravity of exactly sort of which immigration law you would have broken in this context. There could also be a limited jail sentence, though right now jail sentence is less applied, in particular because of coronavirus, and then ultimately deportation. That's, for example, if you don't have a visa, if you come here on the tourist visa and then you're caught working, then that usually leads to deportation. Something like this, it may or may not lead to deportation up to the prosecutors, but there'll definitely be a fine and there could be some kind of a ban from working for the future. So not a good process to go through. So my general advice is just do not buy visas. You can always set up your own company and have your own freelance visa, which is fairly affordable these days. No reason to pay somebody else to be on somebody else's visa because that is improper and against the law.
Okay, thank you, Ludmilla. Staying with paperwork, a no name on this message come in on 4001 saying, I made a Muslim will through a lawyer. The will I received is on the letterhead, an Arabic, translated and stamped. It's not signed by the lawyer, nor is it notarized. Is it legal without any court attestation or notarization? Please advise.
Yeah, that's another sort of improper service, if you will. So for now in the UAE, Muslims cannot have a registered will. So, and these services that, as the listener just shared, are you know, I'm aware of, but they are they're improper because the will is unenforceable. So it's just a piece of document, a piece of paper, and this particular document cannot be enforced in any court. So is it legal? It's not necessarily illegal, but it's utterly unenforceable because for Muslims at this point in time, the only way to register to have a valid and enforceable will is to register it through the local courts. And even then, it must be subject to Sharia, which means they can only will 1/3 of their estate to a non-heir. And it has to be approved and registered with the judge. So anything short of that is not enforceable. And then in this particular case, and this is why there's also not a notary stamp, because if a Muslim person were to go to a notary right now and try to register or to have a will notarized, they would refuse him for the very reason I just described, because that's not a proper process. So just be mindful, all those Muslim expats out there, if somebody does offer you the service, it's not worth it. It's sort of it's a scam.
Lamilla, thank you so much. I'm going to squeeze in one last question, if we can do a quick 10-second answer. Liam, following up, I think, on the pregnancy question, saying, can I live with my girlfriend in a hotel? Presumably long-term hotel, service department hotel. What does the law say about living when you are unmarried?
It's perfectly legal. There's no more penalties applied to anybody who's not married and living together or cohabiting. So it is legal.
There
no reason to worry.
Liam, no need to worry. Let's end it on that happy note. Ludmilla, thank you so much as ever for your time.
Thank you.
If anyone hasn't had the time themselves to get in touch or needs some more specific insights and advice, you can find Ludmilla Umalova at HPL Umalova and Palooka. She's back on a regular basis. We'll have her here in 2 weeks. Always a busy show, so always get your questions in as early as possible.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So we heard about an amazing sneaker brand that uses plastic bottles and bags to make shoes. It's made here in the UAE. Thaili is the brainchild of 19-year-old Ashay, and he's on a mission to address the waste in our seas, to turn that into a completely brand new fabric and really take on the fact that the fashion industry is one of the biggest polluters in the world. He is in India right now, but I got to catch up with him, and he told me where the idea came from.
The idea first started out as a design project. I was working on my design portfolio while I was applying for colleges. And I happened to work on recycling plastic because it's something that's very close to me. So with a lot of experimentation and prototyping, in about a few months, I had a fabric that was very similar to leather. It has similar properties to leather, you know, when it comes to its stiffness and durability. I also had a degree in footwear design, so, you know, naturally I thought the best fit for the material would be sneakers. And then in 2019, I met Matteo at a startup competition held at my university. And then since then, you know, the design project really became a business idea, and then now it's a full-fledged business.
We're going to be speaking to your first investor, Matteo, very soon. So you came up with a fabric, which you make it sound so easy. We did some experimentation and I basically came up with a vegan leather that's made from recycled plastics, like it's no big deal. And you putting together, as you say, your degree in footwear design. What was the experimentation process like? Were any bad turns along the way?
Nobody has really done it before. So it was more of just, you know, trying different things, you know, trying different machinery, you know, different temperatures and time to sort of, you know, convert waste plastic bags into the fabric we call 3D-Tex. It was just more of trial and error and, you know, seeing what really works the best. And then afterwards, you know, after I had a proper process, the next step was mass production and industrializing the entire process, which we're at right now. We've already recycled about 50,000 plastic bags.
Now, you've got your hands full because there are upwards of a trillion plastic bags in production in the world. Why do you feel like it was this eco-friendly approach that was going to be your point of difference?
You know, the thing with plastic bags is that, you know, there was really no way to recycle it. And, you know, which is why nobody really collected these plastic bags. And then we also wanted to find a process that would not cause further damage to the environment. So the current production process of 3D PEG does not require any additional chemicals in the process, neither does it release any toxic chemicals as an end product. We also make sure that, you know, the use of water is limited so that the 3D PEG is finally eco-friendly.
And they look amazing too, by the way. Super sleek. The designs I've seen are really pared back, really timeless, white. I love your font as well. What's it been like to, you know, have that investment and be able to see your shoes on the shelves?
Oh, it's really been, you know, it's been a dream come true. I've always been interested in sneakers since, you know, I was very young. And, you know, to see your shoes, you know, being displayed at Level Shoes, which is the biggest shoe store in the world, is just dream come true, really.
And when you are sitting at your computer designing, or you're speaking to the factories, you're talking to your investor, who is the client? Who's the customer that you have in mind who is going to be bringing together, well, good taste and good conscience when it comes to their footwear? Who is it for?
I would say somebody like me, somebody who's, you know, between the ages of 13 to 40. Somebody who's interested in streetwear, fashion, sneakers, and at the same time also cares for the environment.
I'm going to ask you to kind of predict the future, if you don't mind. Where do you want this to go, Ashay? Where do you think your future is in the future of the company?
You know, so firstly, as I said, 3DEX is almost it's almost a replacement for leather. So I would like to use a material for different applications. You know, anything that uses leather. You know, everything from bags to furniture to maybe even car upholstery.
Sounds like the possibilities are endless. And huge congratulations on having the innovative spirit to create this, not only from nothing, but from something that is ultimately ending up in landfill or in our oceans and ahead of World Ocean Day. Huge congratulations. We're speaking next to Matteo, your first investor. Smart man putting his money on you. Ashay, thank you so, so much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
19-year-old Ashay there in India working on his shoe empire full time. Pretty quick way of making me feel massively inadequate. He's 19. I can tell you what I was doing at 19. It wasn't building a shoe empire, creating a vegan leather by any stretch. So up next, I am speaking with Matteo Boffa, who is his first inventor. A number of questions saying, how do you spell the name of the company? It is Thali. It means like plastic, really, in Hindi, he says. So it's Thaely. And as he said, it's available in Level Shoes. And they look great, honestly. Thaely. Have a nosy. Bit of a game changer.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us on this Monday afternoon. I've been chatting with Ashay, who's 19 and has built a sneaker empire out of, well, plastic bags and bottles. I also caught up with his very first inventor, Matteo Boffa, and asked him, what was your reaction to Ashay's idea?
I started investing in different startups since 6 years now, small, medium amount. And I made many mistakes in the past investment. And what I saw in this young 19 years old that presented this concept, this product, during a pitch competition at the university, I saw more than the product or the idea itself, I saw the person. So I believed in him. And the same day we shook hands and we decided to create a business out of his idea. I have to say, from the first most ugliest pair of shoes he presented to me, we are now one of the most good looking pair of shoes, in my opinion. Maybe Ashay forgot to mention, is not just doing something good for the environment, but the social impact that we have, it's huge. We concentrate all the items that compone these shoes in a very small range of kilometers. So there is no shipping left and right. Who made the shoes is controlled. There is no kids involved. Women are paid same as men. The factory, it's audited by external audit. So for me, it was not just the product itself, but the 360 degree concept behind. If we see, for example, the box, it's a plantable box. So as soon as you throw away the box or the box end up in nature, it will grow basil. So that's
what?
Why they are incredible. Yes.
So you've got shoes made from recycled plastics. You've got a box that is plantable that you can grow herbs from. this is, I mean, if that's not a nice bonus to buying a pair of sneakers, I don't know what is. Yes. How does it work then with scaling up an idea that you see at a university competition to now being in store? Matteo, what are your hopes for the future of this?
The great things is that we collect the interest from investors that didn't just want to put the money in it and see a return. It's people that put the money and want to work for the brand. So we are now, we started between me and Ashai, and now we are 12 people working under the same brand. And everybody is extremely motivated and determined to take this to the next level. We have great support as well from other bigger organizations. And this is the hope to create not a mass production, but to create a product that can leave really a very good footprint on the path of the herd and the people.
I love the idea of a vegan sneaker leaving a good footprint. So it's, as I said, it's a really good looking shoe. You can sleep well at night. I'm just anticipating questions coming in on 4001 about one, how to buy, and two, how much. Can I ask, and how did you guys decide between yourselves about the price point? Matteo, what did you advise?
Yes, so how buying it, again, to be sustainable, we try to avoid to send left and right big quantities of the shoes in different store, because after the return is complicated and is impact as well the environment. So our strategy is mostly to be online, where people can order around the world, and we will try to have the minimum CO2 emission per pair. In terms of the price, we position ourselves 30% cheaper than other brand in the same range. Of course, there is nothing in the market that is similar or competitor to us, but it will be around $99 to make it affordable as well for students and people that want to make a change without changing their portfolio.
Not bad, $99 for a pair. That was Matteo, the very first investor of a company called Thaley. Founded by a 19-year-old, he's now in India overseeing production.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Speaking this afternoon to some incredible young people, we've just been in conversation with Ashay there, who created a sneaker brand. The shoes are made with plastic bags and bottles. He's made them into a vegan leather, and those shoes are now available at one of Dubai's major malls. We're now going to speak to mum and son, Neelam and Diran, who has aspirations of turning his talent into a business. He does elaborate balloon arrangements and hopes to help his mum by making some extra cash with it. They were in a coffee shop when we were chatting. I spoke to Neelam and asked her about her son.
And he has autism, ADHD. He also has some other conditions, some genetical disorders. Diran has been attending a special needs center. He's very passionate about balloon decoration.
So this is something that he's naturally a very creative person, and it's balloons that he's chosen as his medium. When did this start? When did he first start experimenting?
I don't even remember when he started doing the balloons. I just remember when he was very young, he had severe obsession for balloons, even now.
And this is a common trait of people on the autism spectrum, and where fixating on something and becoming, in Diran's case, incredibly talented and competent at one particular talent or hobby, and for balloons. So you said for every birthday, he just wants balloons. He must be doing a lot of practice then to get to the stage where he's at, because his work's amazing.
He's not practicing because he wastes, because the thing is, balloons cost too much. I don't allow him to waste the balloons at times. He keeps on making balloons throughout the day. There is any events happening in Dubai or any festivals, he knows about all the festivals. Say New Year, Valentine's Day, Indian festivals, Christmas, UAE National Day. He's just telling me, UAE National Day, mommy, you forgot.
And this is his chance to use different colours and designs. What are your hopes then that this is going to turn into, Neelam?
To be very honest, Helen, I'm a single mom and I have lost my job since last year. We are really going through a very difficult time being a single mom. And we have been in Dubai for more than 20 years. So currently, balloon decoration is our source of income. But then I just need help and guidance. How do we start it as a business?
So do you have a business license at this stage, Neelam, or not?
Not yet. But we really need somebody who can guide us how to start this as a business. I really don't have anybody to guide me.
Well, we know lots of people here at Dubai Eye who have started businesses, and those who've been involved from things like setting up social media accounts. There's lots of people I would like to connect you with. If anyone's listening today and they can help, as you say, you don't even necessarily need a website, but maybe it's just Instagram and a way of getting your message out to people. We can make this happen and make sure that you and you can support your son and support yourself. Because as you said, he's got incredible talent. And this is something that really needs to be encouraged. It's something that you guys need as a family to keep you living in Dubai, which is where you want to stay, right?
That's true. We have been in Dubai for 20 years. Ian is born and brought up here. Very honestly, Dubai is our first house.
We're lucky to have you here. We really, really are. And we'll share some photos on our social media of Dhiren and his work that he's done. And anything that we can do with connecting with people here in Dubai to make this happen, we'll just keep in touch if that's okay with you.
Because I already have a stress of my visa, how to continue. You require a visa to stay in Dubai. And I couldn't find anybody yet, very honestly. I've been asking so many people, I can't tell you.
Anything that anyone can do to get that message out there, and we'll forward any messages that come in on 4001 or on the ARN Play app, so we can connect you with some potential customers and see where it goes from there.
Thank you so much, Helen. Thank you so much for your support. And it's like only me and my son. We don't have anybody else in the team. So I'm also looking out for somebody who can help us, assist us.
Is Dhiren there to have a little chat with, Neelam?
Yeah, sure.
Hello.
Hi, Dhiren. How are you?
Fine.
I love the sound of your business. It sounds like you enjoy it so much.
Yes.
What is it about the balloons and making people happy that makes you so happy?
Yes.
What's your favorite? What's been your favorite creation that you've made so far? Favorite color?
The UAE flag.
Yeah. What is it about the flag that you like?
And yes.
You want to make this into a business?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to make it happen. So thank you so much for being with us today. And
yes.
Amazing to see you supporting your mum with your creativity.
Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful young man.
Yes.
So if anyone can help with this business, please do reach out on 4001. If anyone's got any special occasions coming up, we will put you in touch with Neelam and Dhiren to make it all come together. So let's get some positive coming out of this. So Dhiren, thank you so much. What would you say to anyone who's planning a party?
Please support me.
There you go. That's exactly what you need to do. Dhiren, thank you to you and your mum. And we'll talk to you very soon. That was Neelam, a single mum who's been out of a job since last year, and her son Dhiren, who's incredibly talented, a young man of determination, and he loves doing balloon arrangements and looking to turn this into a business. If you've got any leads or would like to help out and lend your skills in social media, marketing, setting up a business, or just some emotional support, let us know.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.